repeat of the steel mills. It was a black and dirty street down which I made my way that November morning at 5:30. There was no paving, no sidewalk, no lights. Rain had been falling for days, and I waded through seas of mud and sloshed through lakes of water. There were men in front of me and men behind me, all plodding along through the mire, just as I was plodding along, their tin lunch pails rattling as mine was rattling. Some of us were going to work. Some of us were going to look for work. The steel mills lay somewhere in the darkness ahead of us. We who were not so fortunate as to possess a magical piece of brass, the showing of which would cause the steel mill gate to swing open, waited outside in the street. It was cold out there. A north wind blowing straight in from the lake whipped our faces and hands and penetrated our none too heavy clothing. "I wish I had a job in there," said a shivering man at my side. "You got a job?" he asked, glancing at my pail. I told him I had been promised work and had been ordered to report. "You're lucky to get a job," he began to kick his muddy shoes against the fence and blow upon his hands. "Winter's coming," he sighed. A whistle blew, a gate swung open, and a mob of men poured out into the street, the night shift going off duty. Their faces looked haggard and deathly pale in the sickly glare of the pale blue arcs above us. "Night work's no good," said the small man at my side, "but you gotta do it if you're gonna work in the mills." A man with a Turkish towel thrown about his neck came out of the gate and looked critically at the job hunters. He came up to me. "What's your name?" he demanded. I told him. "Come on," he grunted. We stopped before the uniformed guard, who wrote my name on a card, punched the card, and gave it to me. "Come on," again grunted the man with the towel. I followed my guide into the yard, over railroad tracks, past great piles of scrap iron and pig metal, through clouds of steam and smoke, and into a long black building where engines whistled, bells clanged, and electric cranes rumbled and rattled overhead. Through a long hot tunnel down which I saw red arms of flame reaching, we made our way. We came to an iron stairway, climbed it, and stepped out upon a steel floor into the open hearth. Scattered here and there, I saw groups of men at work in front of big house-like furnaces out of whose mouths white tongues of flame were leaping. The men worked naked to the waist or stripped to overalls and undershirt, and watching them, I began to wonder if I had chosen wisely in seeking and accepting employment in this inferno. "Put your pail there. Hang your coat there. Sit down there. I'll tell the boss you're here." The man with the towel went away. I watched a man who worked at one of the doors of the furnace nearest me. He had thrust a bar of iron through the peephole and was jabbing and prying at some object inside. Every ounce of his strength he was putting into his efforts. I could hear him grunt as he pulled and pushed, and I saw the perspiration dripping from his face and naked arms. He withdrew the bar. The end that had been inside the door came out as white and as pliable as a hank of taffy, and dropped it to the floor. He shouted some command to an invisible person, and the door rose slowly and quietly, disclosing a great snow-white cavern in whose depths bubbled and boiled a lake of steel. With a quick movement of his hand, the workman dropped a pair of dark-colored spectacles before his eyes, and his arms went up before his face to shield it from the blast that poured out through the open door where he stood. Silhouetted against that piercing light, stooping and peering, tiptoeing and bending, cringing and twisting, as he tried to examine something back in the furnace. Then, with another shout, he caused the door to slip down into its place. He came walking across the floor to where I sat and stopped in front of me. The sweat fell from his blistered face, ran in tiny rivulets from his arms and hands, and splashed on the iron floor. He trembled, gasped for breath, and I thought he was going to sink down from exhaustion, when to my surprise he deliberately winked at me. Ought never to have left the farm, ought we, eh, buddy?" he said with a chuckle, and that was my introduction to Pete. The best open hearth man I ever knew, a good fellow, clean and honest. "Mike, put this guy to wheeling in manganese," said a voice behind me, and I turned and saw the boss. "Get that wheelbarrow over yonder and foller me," instructed Mike. a little old white-haired Irishman called the maid of all work about the plant. I picked up the heavy iron wheelbarrow and trundled it after him, out to a building where the alloys used in steelmaking were kept. "Now then, you load your wheelbarrow up with this manganese and weigh it over on the scales yonder, and then wheel it in and put it behind number 4, Mike told me. "Why is manganese put into steel?" I asked Pete on one of my trips past his furnace. "It settles it, toughens it up, and makes it so it'll roll," he answered. All day I trundled the iron wheelbarrow along the iron floor, wheeling in manganese. I watched the powerful electric cranes picking up the heavy boxes of material and dumping their contents into the furnaces. I watched the tapping of the heats when the dams holding in the boiling lakes would be broken down and the fiery floods would go rushing and roaring into the ladles, these to be whisked away to the ingot molds. And I watched the men at work, saw the strain they were under, saw the risks they took, and wondered if after a few days I could be doing what they were doing. "It's all very interesting," I said to Pete as I stood near him waiting for a crane to pass by. He grinned. "Uh-huh. But you'll get over it. About tomorrow morning when your clock goes rattly bang and you look to see what's up and find it's 5 o'clock, you'll not be thinking it so interesting. Oh, no. Let's see your hands." He laughed when he saw the blisters the handles of the wheelbarrow had developed. Pete was right. When my alarm clock awakened me next morning, I started to get out of bed and groaned in agony. Every muscle of my body ached. I fancied my joints creaked as I sat on the edge of the couch, vainly endeavoring to get them to working freely and easily. The breakfast bell rang twice, but hurry I could not. "You'll be late to work. The others have gone," called the landlady. I managed to creak downstairs. My pail was packed, and she had tied up an extra lunch in a newspaper. "You can't stop to eat if you want to get to work on time," she said. "Your breakfast is in this paper. Eat it when you get to the mills." I stumbled away in the darkness, groaning and gasping, and found my way to the black and dirty street. The mud was frozen hard now, the pools of water were ice-covered, and my heavy working shoes thumped and bumped along the dismal road in a remarkably noisy manner. The number of job hunters was larger this morning. Among them I saw the small man who could not get took, and again he was peeking wishfully through the knothole in the fence. "You're on, eh?" he said when he spied me. "I wish I was. Say, you haven't got a dime you could spare a feller, have you?" I discovered a dime. I showed my brass check a timekeeper had given me one the day before, number 1266, to the uniformed watchman. He waved me on and I entered the gate just as the whistle blew. A minute later and I would have been docked half an hour. Mike took me in hand as soon as I came on the floor and proceeded to give me a few pointers. "I kept me eye on ye all day yesterday, and you fair disgusted me with the way ye cavorted around with the Irish boogie, as though ye wanted to do it all in the first day. Now you're on a 12-hour turn here, and you're not expected to work like a fool. You'll get in bad with the boss if he sees ye chinnin' with Pete. He doesn't like Pete, and Pete doesn't like him, and I don't blame Pete. The boss has brainstorms. Watch out for him." I followed much of Mike's advice. All that day I trundled the wheelbarrow, but I made an easier day of it, and no one objected to my work. And as the days ran by, I found my muscles toughening, and I could hear the alarm bell at 5 in the morning without feeling compelled to squander several valuable minutes in wishing I had been born rich. For 2 weeks I worked every day at wheeling in materials for the furnaces. Then one day, when a workman dropped a piece of pig iron on his foot and was sent to the hospital, I was put on second helping. By good luck, I was sent to Pete's furnace. Pete and I by this time were great cronies. Many a chat we had had back behind his furnace, hidden from the prying eyes of the boss. I found Mike was right. It was just as well to keep out of his sight. I soon discovered that he did not like Pete. In numberless mean and petty ways did he harass the man, trying to make him do something that would give an excuse to discharge him. But Pete was slow to anger, and with admirable strength he kept his feelings under control. I was working nights now every other week. The small man at the gate, he had finally got took and was laboring in the yard gang, who had told me that night work is no good, knew what he was talking about. I found night work absolutely no good. The small hours of the night are the terror of the night worker. Sometimes when we had had a particularly hard spell of work and were dead beat with fatigue and exhaustion, then Pete might be expected to put his well-known question. "Ought to have stayed on the farm, oughtn't we? Hey, buddy?" The foolish question and his comical way of asking it always made me laugh. Seeing that Pete had once been a farm laborer, the remark was not so silly after all. It was his way of comparing two kinds of work. It was his favorite stock jest. "I know farm work, too, from pigs to potatoes, and I do not believe there is any kind of farm work 10 hours of which can equal 30 minutes of splashing on an open hearth furnace in muscle-tearing, nerve-racking, back-breaking, sweat-bringing effort." Pete and I were working on No. 3 furnace, the latest type and the fastest of any in the group. Its monthly output was 300 or 400 tons more than that of any other. It belonged to Pete by rights. He was the oldest man on the floor, and he was regarded by all the other furnace men as the best first helper in the plant. No other first helper watched his roof so carefully as did he. No other could get as many heats from a roof as did he. For every 350 heats tapped from a furnace before the furnace required a new roof, the company gave the first helper a bonus of $50. This was to encourage them to watch their furnaces closely, to see that the gas did not touch the roofs. One morning, Pete and I were notified that we were transferred to No. 10, the oldest, the slowest, and hardest furnace to work of any. Lewis, a Welshman, a friend of the boss, was to take No. 3. Pete would lose the bonus money due in 30 days. "What's this for?" he demanded of the boss. "Because you don't watch your furnace," snarled the boss in reply. "You've touched that roof. There are icicles on it right now." Pete walked over to the air valves, jerked the lever, and threw up the middle door. "Show me an icicle in there," he cried. "I'll give you $500 for every one you point out." "Lower that door," roared the boss, "and get down to No. 10, or go get your time if you prefer." Pete was silent for a moment, then he threw up his head and laughed. Going to his locker, he took out his lunch pail and started for No. 10. "I rather think I'm going to take a trip back to Minnesota pretty soon to see the folks, you know," he said to me that afternoon. No. 10 melted, soft that day, and Pete could not get the heat hot. We pigged steadily for 2 hours, but it remained cold and dead. We were played out when about 4 o'clock the boss came up. "Why don't you get that heat out?" he demanded. "You've been 10 hours at it already." Pete made no reply. "Where's a test bar?" He shoved the test bar into the bath, moved it slowly back and forth, and withdrew it. "She's hot now. Take her out." Pete looked at the end of the bar. It was ragged, not bitten off clean as it would have been had the temperature of the bath been right. "She's a long way from being hot," he said, pointing at the test bar. "Don't you dispute me," roared the boss. "If I say she's hot, she's hot. If I tell you to take her out, you take her out." We took out the heat, and a miserable mess there was. It was so cold it froze up in the tap hole. It froze up in the runner. It froze in the ladle. The entire heat was lost. It was an angry crew of men that worked with sledge bars and picks cleaning up the mess. I was sorry the boss could not know how much that bunch of men loved him. I saw him approaching Pete. I saw him shaking his clenched fist. I heard an ugly word. The lie was passed, a blow was struck, and the long-expected fight was on. Out on the smooth iron floor, in the glare of the furnace flames, someone had hoisted the 3 doors to the top. The two enemies fought it out. They were giants in build, both of them muscled like gladiators. It was a brutal, savage exhibition. Finally, the boss reeled, dropped to his knees, swayed back and forth, and went down. Pete, having floored the boss, took a bath, changed his clothes, shook hands all around, and came seeking me. "Well, buddy, I'm off," he chuckled, peeping at me from a chink in his swollen face. "Like as not, I'll be shucking pumpkins up in Minnesota this time next week. Oh, no use my trying to stick it out here. You can't stay here, you know, when you've had a go with the boss. So long." I did not go to work the next day nor the next. I was deliberating whether I would go back at all the morning of the third day when Mike came looking for me. "Pete wants you to come to work," he announced. "Pete?" I said, wondering what he meant.
"You said it. Pete's boss now."
"No."
"Yes."
"Oh, the super, he isn't blind. He knew what was going on. He did, and he didn't take him long to fix him when he'd heard the particulars. I'll tell Pete you'll be coming along soon," and Mike departed. I went back and resumed my old position on number 3 with John Jakubowski, a Pole. Jakubowski was an exceptionally able furnace man and an agreeable fellow workman. There was great rejoicing all over the plant because our old boss was out, and there was general satisfaction over Pete's appointment to his place. This feeling among the men was soon reflected in the output of the furnaces. Our tonnage showed a steady increase. Pete was nervous and ill at ease for a few weeks. He was afraid he would make some mistake that would show him to be unworthy of the trust the superintendent had placed in him. "No education. That's where I'm weak," he said to me in one of our confidential chats. "Can't write, can't figure, can't talk. Don't know nothing. It's embarrassing. The super tells me to use 2,000 of manganese on a 150,000-pound charge. That's easy. I just tell a hunky to wheel in 2,000. But suppose that lunkhead out in them scales goes wrong and charges in 165,000 pounds and doesn't tell me until 10 minutes before we're ready to tap. How am I going to figure out how much more manganese to put in? Or when the chief clerk writes me a nice letter requesting a statement showing how many of my men have more than 10 children, how many of them can read the Declaration of Independence, and how many of them eat oatmeal for breakfast? Why, I'm up against it, I tell you. No education. I reckon I ought never to have left the farm, eh, buddy?" I understood Pete's gentle hint, and I took care of his clerical work, writing what few letters he had to send out, making up his statements, doing his calculating, and so forth. 6 months passed. Pete had made good. The management was highly pleased with him as a melter. Success had come to me, too, in a modest way. I had been given a furnace. I was now a first helper. It was about the time I took the furnace that I began to notice a falling off in the number of requests from Pete for assistance. I thought little of it, supposing that he was getting his work done by one of the weighers. But one night when I went down to his office to have a chat, I found him seated at his little desk, poring over an arithmetic. He looked up at me and grinned in a rather shamefaced manner. "Oh, that's it, is it?" I said. "Now I understand why I'm no longer of any use to the boss." "Well, I just had to do something," he laughed. "Couldn't afford to go right on being an ignoramus all the time." "Are you studying it all alone?" "You bet I'm not. I'd never get there if I was. I've a teacher, a private teacher. He comes every other night when I'm working days and every other afternoon when I'm working nights. But I'm a bonehead. He's told me so a dozen times. But the other day he said he thought I was softening up a bit." Good old Pete. I left him that night with my admiration for the man increased 100 times. Another 6 months passed, 6 months of hard, grinding toil, and yet a 6 months I look back on with genuine pleasure. I now had the swing of the work, and it came easy. Conditions about the plant under Pete's supervision were ideal. I was making progress in the work. We were making good money. Then came the black day. How quickly it happened. I had tapped my furnace, and the last of the heat had run into the ladle. "Hoist away!" I heard Pete shout to the crane man. The humming sound of the motors getting into action came to my ears. The giant crane was groaning and whining as it slowly lifted its 80-ton burden from the pit where the ladle stood. It was then 5 or 6 feet above the pit's bottom. Pete was leaning over the railing of the platform directly in front of the rising ladle. Suddenly something snapped among the shafts and cables. I saw 2 men in the crane cab go swarming up the escape ladder. I saw the ladle drop as a broken cable went flying out of the sheave. A great white wave of steel washed over the ladle's rim, and another, down upon a shallow pool of water that a leaking hose had formed. The steel was splashed, and as it struck, the explosion came. I was blown from my feet and rolled along the floor. The air was filled with bits of fiery steel, brick, and debris of all kinds. I crawled to shelter behind a column, and there beat out the flames that were burning my clothing in a half dozen places. Then, groping through the dust and smoke that choked the building, I went to look for Pete. Near the place where I had seen him standing when the ladle fell, I found him. Two workmen who had been crouching behind a wall when the explosion came and were unhurt were tearing his burning clothes from his blackened body. Somebody brought a blanket and he wrapped it about him. We doubt if he lived, but as we carried him back, I noted he was trying to speak and stooped. I caught the words, "Ought never to have left the farm, ought we, eh, buddy?" That was the last time I ever heard Pete speak. That was the last time I ever heard him alive. 2 o'clock in the morning, sitting at the little desk where I found Pete that night, poring over his arithmetic, I have been writing down my early experiences in the open hearth. Here comes Jakubowski with a test. I know exactly what he will say. Had I better give her a dose of ore? 2 o'clock in the morning, the small man at the gate was right. Night work is no good. I was mistaken. Jakubowski doesn't ask his customary question. He looks at me curiously. "You don't look good, boss," he says. "You sick, maybe?" "Yes, I'm sick. I always am at 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm on the night shift. I stretch, I yawn, I shudder. Ought never to have left the farm, ought we, eh, Jakubowski?" I say to the big pole.